Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm going to turn on this lavalier microphone so that you can all hear me. It's a pleasure to occasionally leave the blue state precincts of New York City and to come to a newly red state, at least if you're the 2010 elections were any indication. You are now a red state. Some of you are applauding. And it's a pleasure to be here. And to see such a large audience coming to hear what I have to say. My topic tonight is the evolution of American attitudes on Palestine over the last half century or so, 60, 70, 80 years. And what I'm going to try and indicate is that I think there have been some changes, but I want to talk a little bit about the baseline from which those changes start. I think it can be argued that Palestine, the people of Palestine, the country, have been largely absent from American public discourse for most of the past century. Its place was taken, was filled, by an almost exclusive focus on the Zionist narrative of modern Jewish history and a focus on Israel. Many factors played a part in creating a positive image of Israel and in occluding any real sense of Palestine or the Palestinian people in the American public consciousness. A crucial role in this process was played by both scholarly writings and non-academic writings, novels and other forms of writings in English, and later by movies, television, and other media. I think it's insufficiently recognized in the focus on things like diplomacy or warfare, that establishing the hegemony of Zionism in the field of ideas and in public discourse in this country and elsewhere was a vital precondition for its successes in the political and diplomatic arenas and on the battlefield. The discursive victories of Zionism, in other words, preceded these triumphs. I think it can be argued that the latter would never have occurred but for the former. In other words, in addition to being successful as an idea, as a national movement, as a colonial settler phenomenon in Palestine, political Zionism has always been a resounding public relations triumph. It was the case, and I heard this from my parents, who lived in New York in the 1940s before I was born, that the Zionist narrative was already virtually uncontested in this country even before 1948. It has obviously become more firmly entrenched in the decades since. And it shouldn't be very hard to understand why this is the case. Historically, Zionist and later Israeli leaders with a good strategic sense, with an understanding of American and European public opinion, with a keen eye to opportunity, understood where to focus their efforts to garner international support. You can't really say the same thing of Arab leaders. They had nothing like the understanding of Western countries or of Western public opinion, and they were not as sensible or strategic in their approach to this issue. I think that this was absolutely vital to the effort of these Zionist and later Israeli leaders to create a Jewish state in what was in 1948 a country with an Arab majority. I mean, I think you have to think about that. This is a country with a large Arab majority in 1948, and the idea was to create a Jewish state there, even in the part of Palestine which was apportioned to the Jewish state under the 1947 partition plan. Nearly half of the population would have been Arab. Most of the land would have been Arab-owned. This would have been a difficult prospect under any circumstances, and to create a strong, indeed an impregnable position for it in a hostile region would have been even harder. I think it would have been impossible, and most historians agree, that it would have been impossible for them to have succeeded in this endeavor without great external assistance. Now, we know that they started in this endeavor with a great advantage. In this country in particular, in the familiarity of the biblical narrative to Americans and the sympathy for a Jewish return to the Holy Land that in fact dates back to the 19th century and even before in the United States and Europe. Christian Zionism, in other words, has always been a crucial ally, a sort of sentimental Christian Zionism has always been there. And Christian Zionism has always been a crucial ally of the Zionist movement, whether we're talking about Britain at the turn of the 20th century leading up to the Balfour Declaration, or whether we're talking about the United States in the era of Wilson or the era of Truman or the era of Reagan or today. Now, while for well over a half a century, the Zionist and later the Israeli narrative was just as triumphant in the Western public sphere as were its protagonists in Palestine, it has recently faced some challenges to this predominance. I'll talk about them briefly at the end of my talk. In some quarters, however, even to suggest that this narrative is preeminent, not to say hegemonic, is considered offensive. The very idea that this is almost the only set of ideas about this conflict that most people have had access to, they have not had the opportunity to hear anything else, is considered offensive. At the same time, there's strong resistance to any attempt to suggest that Israel was not or is not always and invariably the underdog and the victim. There's very strong resistance to this. This sense of victimization is a cornerstone of the Zionist narrative. Instead of Zionist and Israeli history being told as the succession of triumphs that is the real story of the modern Jewish national presence in Palestine, it's generally treated as a coda to the tragedy of Jewish victimhood throughout the history of Christian Europe, culminating in the Holocaust. So it's seen as part of a tale in which the Jewish people are always seen as victims, even when they are triumphing in Palestine, or later on in conflicts with the Arab states. Until well after the 1967 war, the tenor of discourse about Palestine in the American public sphere continued to be dominated by an Israeli point of view. Critics of Israel received little or no attention. They could not get into the media, and otherwise they had very little access. And Arabs, the Arab states, and Arab Americans made limited and very ineffectual attempts to make their voices heard. What was available to most people in the way of books and movies and so forth mirrored the Israeli narrative of a heroic anti-colonial struggle for self-determination against the callous and anti-Semitic British. All of this against the background of an unfeeling world. There was no sense in what was mostly available to people that without the British, the Zionist movement could not possibly have established itself so successfully in Palestine in the 20s and the 30s. In virtually all writings and media coverage before 1967, and indeed well after that, Arabs generally were portrayed very negatively, in fact, in an overtly racist fashion in many cases, with dark hints that they were driven in what they do by anti-Semitism and indeed were Nazi sympathizers. Meanwhile, much focus was put on the Mufti, who in fact was a collaborator with the Nazis and played a role in World War II, an evil role in World War II. Meanwhile, with all the focus on the Mufti, nothing was said about the contribution of literally hundreds of thousands of Arab soldiers to the Allied victory in World War II, of entire divisions of Moroccans, Algerians and Tunisians who fought with the Free French Army, and of Palestinians, Jordanians, and Egyptians who fought with the British, completely ignored in the historical record or in people's minds. The Palestinians were described not as people trying to defend themselves, but rather as murderous and irrational enemies of the Jews. There was no reason for this in the depiction that we were given of the Palestinians. They were just like the Cossacks. They just hated. That was the description. And they were described as having left their homes and their homeland in 1948, essentially because their leaders told them to, the better to enable the greatly superior invading Arab armies to wipe out the fledgling Jewish state. This was the picture most people were given. Little attention was paid to the actual nature of the forced flight of the majority of the Palestinian population in 1948, or to the fate of those who were left behind in Israel, living under military rule under a system of surveillance and movement controls for the first 18 years of Israel's independence until 1966. Little attention was paid to the systematic discrimination that the 20% of Israelis who are of Arab origin have suffered since then. These myths and many others, these omissions and many others, were hammered home relentlessly in this country via every possible medium, and they came to be nearly universally believed. Only recently was it possible to find works by trade publishers that shattered these myths, and now you can actually find books that show that almost everything I've related as the common depiction of this is completely false. Interestingly, in looking at this, I have come to the absolute conviction, partly from my own experience, but from reading about this, that the iconic work of the period of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s in this regard, in terms of establishing these images, was not a scholarly book, but was rather a thoroughly mediocre, but nevertheless highly influential novel by one Leon Uris, entitled Exodus, a novel of Israel. Anybody who's over 45 or 50 probably has read it or knows about it. If you didn't read it or know about it, a book, by the way, which equaled the sales of Gone with the Wind, which was the highest-selling novel in American history. You saw the Academy Award-winning 1960 movie of the same name with the young, handsome Paul Newman as Ari Ben-Kanan. I would argue that this book probably, and the movie, obviously, probably more to disseminate these and other fanciful and ahistorical ideas than all English language publications to this point combined. I have no evidence for this, but I do believe it's true. The book, some people think, was just written on a whim by Leon Uris, who had just written a best-selling World War II novel. That's not the case. The book was commissioned. It was commissioned by a renowned professional public relations expert, Edward Gottlieb. He's considered one of the fathers of the field of public relations, who was a man who had been tasked with improving Israel's image in the late 50s, and who chose Uris to write this novel, who gave him the money for his trip to Israel, essentially for that purpose. I think many of the basic ideas about Palestine and Israel held by one or two generations of Americans who came to maturity in those decades find their origin either in this trite novel or in the equally cliched movie. Gottlieb's inspiration to send Leon Uris to Israel may thus have constituted one of the greatest advertising triumphs of the entire 20th century. Now, I will tell you that the account that was purveyed in Exodus, the movie and the book, and in most of the mainstream media for many decades, was totally at odds with reality. Among the main points that were obscured by this narrative was Israel's responsibility for the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians, who are a majority of the country's Arab population, from most parts of the country. A huge edifice of pseudo-scholarship and of propaganda was devoted to obscuring this reality and to showing that the Arabs were much stronger than the Jews in Palestine. They were more numerous, but they actually were not stronger. And that they and the Arab states had both the intention and the capability to strangle the infant Israeli state at birth. These assertions, in fact, are unfounded, but they precisely mirrored the key founding myths of Israel. It really wasn't until decades after 1948, until the late 1980s, that a counter-narrative to this one, a counter-narrative that revealed the true nature of the ethnic cleansing that took place in 1948, the true nature of the balance of forces between the Arab states and Israel, and many other things, was thoroughly substantiated by research, essentially by Israeli scholars who were able to work on documents from the newly released documents from the Israel State Archives. And since then, no reputable scholar disagrees with those conclusions, whether about the refugee crisis or many other issues in 1948. Now, all of this took place against the background of crucial changes in the 1960s and onwards in the self-image of the American Jewish community and in American attitudes towards Israel. As the historian Peter Novick, who was actually a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, showed in his masterful book, The Holocaust in American Life, several factors in this period increased the attachment to Israel of the American Jewish community. One of them was the heightened prominence that was given in American public life and in Jewish public and Jewish life to the Holocaust, which came to be seen as a central feature in American Jewish identity. This is sometime in the 60s, Novick shows. There were also changes in aspects of that identity as a result of the June 1967 war, which had a galvanizing effect on American Jewish attachment to Israel and on American attitudes towards Israel generally. In part, this was a function of a new myth, which connected with increased awareness of the Holocaust. This was that on the eve of the June war, Israel faced the possibility of what was described as another Holocaust at the hands of the massed Arab armies just before the June war. Among the generations of Americans who reached maturity before and after the 67 war, this myth has achieved a nearly sacrosanct status, rather like the myth that the Arab states wanted to drive the Jews into the sea in 1948. The Arab states offered the idea of a Jewish-Arab federation. They didn't want to drive the Jewish population to the sea. They opposed a Jewish state, but they didn't want to drive the population into the sea, but everybody came to believe that they did. This is the case insofar as 67 is concerned. Although all serious scholarship and new scholarship confirms this, has shown that notwithstanding the vivid fears of both the Israeli public and the American Jewish community, Israeli and American military and intelligence analysts in 1967 unanimously concurred, without exception, that Israel would under any circumstances crush the Arab armies, whether or not Israel attacked first. That is a fact. That's what the intelligence analysts knew. That's what the military knew, not just the American military, the Israeli military. They confirmed that Israel was never, therefore, in any danger of defeat, let alone extermination. There was no possibility, in other words, of a second Holocaust. Nevertheless, this myth and these fears were brilliantly exploited at the time and afterwards in order to cement sympathy for Israel. Now, the growing emphasis on the Holocaust, the growing realization of the impact of the Holocaust, the growing attention to Holocaust survivors, all of this started in the 60s, together with the increased identification with Israel, grew into what have now been institutionalized as central pillars of American Jewish identity in ways that really were not true previously. If you go back and talk to people about what American Jewish communal life was like in the 40s or the 50s, you'll see what I'm talking about. American Jewish identity has thus evolved over time and has become much more focused on Israel than before, at a time when overt discrimination in the United States against Jews was gradually declining, and there was a much greater degree of communal self-confidence and communal assertiveness than had been the case before. These shifts in the views of several generations of American Jews who came to maturity before and after 67 were mirrored by a transformation in how key segments of U.S. public opinion generally came to view Israel. And an important factor in influencing American public opinion in general was the fact that at this time, in the mid-60s, the U.S. government was increasingly coming to see Israel as an ally and a proxy in its Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union and its Arab clients in the Middle East. We think that this is always the case from 1948. In fact, it was not. The United States and the Soviet Union both supported the founding of Israel in 47-48. Both the United States and the Soviet Union opposed the Anglo-French-Israeli attack on Egypt in 1956. So there was no Cold War alignment with the Arabs, with the Soviets, and Israel with the United States in the 40s or in the 50s. Israel had not been considered a strategic asset to American policymakers from the Truman administration right through the Kennedy administration. However, by the mid-60s, and certainly by the time of the June War, the United States had become completely aligned with Israel against the Arab states that were supported by the USSR. And this configuration really continued right through the end of the Cold War in 1990. Israel has been considered a strategic asset ever since, although there is currently some questioning of its strategic value in some American policymaking circles. This shift, it's a very important shift to a full U.S. alignment with Israel on a Cold War basis or in Cold War terms, was a long time coming, and there were many steps along the way. These steps included President Kennedy's delivery of the first ever U.S. military equipment to Israel in the early 1960s, President Johnson's growing alienation from Egypt as a result of its involvement in the Yemeni Civil War in the early to mid-1960s, and President Johnson's deep sympathy for Israel. After President Truman, Johnson was perhaps the most sympathetic American president up to that time. This sympathy was derived partly from the president's longstanding, very close, in some cases intimate friendships with many major donors to the Democratic Party who were fervently pro-Israel. In his capacity as Senate Majority Leader, he developed these relationships, and they had a big influence on him when he was president. The searing impact of the Vietnam War on policymakers was also a factor in causing them to see the Middle East in starker Cold War terms than had been the case previously. The June War itself played a big role in this closer American alignment with Israel. This Israeli victory showed U.S. policymakers who were deeply shaken by what was happening in Vietnam and who were deeply alienated by the Soviet-aligned Arab nationalist regimes that Israel could serve American interests in opposing the Soviet Union in this region. The defeat of the Soviet-supplied Arab armies provided a welcome triumph for the free world, as it was described, at a time when the news from Southeast Asia was generally bad. After 67, public opinion largely tended to follow the lead of the policymakers in looking at the Middle East in these Cold War terms. There was a further demonization of the Arabs. There was a further demonization of the Palestinians and of the PLO. The dominant narrative emphasized their alignment with the Soviet Union in the Cold War and their terrorist proclivities. These tropes persisted in the rhetoric of the U.S. government. They still persist in the rhetoric of our Congress and in much of the media. Through the end of the Cold War, and with slight modifications, they continue until the present day, where the Palestinians are concerned. Now, this is the background I wanted to give you, against which we have to measure change. And in terms of objective history, or in terms of anything but a position entirely supportive of Israel, it's a pretty bleak situation. I think that in the decades since 1967, there have been some positive changes in U.S. perceptions of the Palestine question generally and of the relationship between Palestinians and Israelis in particular. The growth of Palestinian activism, of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement, had an impact on many. Now, it's true, this movement was tarred successfully by its opponents with the brush of terrorism. That's all that some people could see in the Palestinians. But nevertheless, for the first time, the human face of the Palestinians, which had previously been almost totally occluded, hidden, was discerned for the first time in the American media from sometime in the late 60s onwards. At the same time as the Cold War alignment with Israel was firming up, there was the beginning of a perception of the Palestinians in some terms other than the terms defined by their enemies. The 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, which killed 17,000 people, most of them civilians, the 10-week siege and bombardment of Beirut during that war, and the subsequent Sabra and Shatila massacres, all of which were heavily covered in the U.S. media, played a big role in changing American views of who was David and who was Goliath in this conflict. The first Palestinian Intifada, which started in 1987, reinforced the sense in American public opinion of the Palestinians as underdogs, and this too was heavily covered in the U.S. media. Finally, the Madrid-Oslo peace process, which saw the PLO engaged in negotiations with Israel, had an impact in furthering this process. Now, there's no question that much of this progress in perceptions of the Palestinians was undone by the impact of the second Intifada, which began in 2000, and especially by Palestinian suicide bombings of Israeli civilian targets. These events shocked most Americans who had been deeply affected by the suicide attacks of 9/11, and they reestablished an old perception of Palestinians as irrationally violent and of Israelis as innocent victims, even as things were happening that caused other people to question that depiction. The Israeli government and its supporters in this country did everything possible to reinforce this narrative of the Palestinians as fanatical terrorists indistinguishable from Al-Qaeda. Nevertheless, the space had already been opened up for somewhat more nuanced and somewhat more balanced views of the entire conflict. The very term Palestine or Palestinians, once considered taboo in polite society, such was the success of a century of relentless efforts to replace Palestine with Israel, this term or these terms were now more acceptable and less controversial than had been the case previously. You couldn't really talk about Palestine or Palestinians without being considered offensive in many quarters in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. That began to change. The result was the publication of works that enabled Americans, I would argue for the first time, to have access to versions of Middle Eastern realities which reflected a variety of contrasting perspectives. It's not like they were brainwashed by the other side. It's that for the first time they actually could see more than one point of view. Up to that point, I would argue, pretty much only one point of view was available to them. An important role in this process was played not only by the publication of the work of Israel's so-called new historians, the ones who revealed in the late 1980s various facts from the Israeli archives about the 1948 war, but also by writings of some of the most respected scholars in Israeli academic life, political scientists, sociologists, anthropologists, and so forth. They showed that the one-dimensional perspective that was offered by the Israeli government and by its American apologists was far more impoverished than the broad range of views available within Israeli society itself. And I would say that something else that played a role in this was the publication in English of Haaretz. The very fact that you could read an Israeli paper, and later on of Yediot, the largest selling Israeli paper, the very fact that you could read what Israelis had access to, one side of the argument on the Israeli in Israel and the other side of the argument in Israel, meant that you had infinitely more access to infinitely more points of view than the sort of mainstream perspective that you got in this country. Many other books have been published on aspects of Palestine and Israel in recent years that have broadened the range of what is available to scholars and general readers. This is a function partly of developments in academia, but also of the increased willingness of trade publishers who shy away from controversy and basically want to make money selling books to consider publishing books that would previously have been considered too provocative to sell well. A reticence on this score, plus the blatant biases in favor of Israel of many people in the publishing industry, was always adduced as the reason that mainstream publishers would not touch works that presented a version of reality other than that emanating from an entirely pro-Israeli perspective. However, in the mid-2000s, 2005, 2006, 2007, a number of books were published. In particular, in 2006, Jimmy Carter's Palestine, A Peace Not Apartheid, and John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt's 2007 book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, were published and, strikingly, were major publishing successes. They were badly received by some people, well received by others, but they sold very, very well, both books. They've shown that it is possible to publish profitably works that are critical of the received pro-Israel version of events. Now, this doesn't mean that good books on Palestine or books that are critical of Israel or books by good Israeli scholars are always successful. Many have not been. I have a list of them in my footnotes of really wonderful books that were published, but which haven't done terribly well. Nevertheless, several decades ago, none of these works would have found mainstream trade publishers at all, would have been reviewed had they been published. And now they are beginning to be. To this, I think, has to be added some changes on U.S. campuses where the issue of Palestine and Israel is concerned. This was already clear to key figures in the Israel advocacy establishment as early as 2002, when the Jewish Telegraphic Agency published a remarkable piece entitled "Jewish Groups Coordinate Efforts to Help Students," and then in quotes, "Take Back Campus." That's the title of the piece. This article and many others published at the same time in the U.S. Jewish press and in the Israeli press in 2003, 2002, 2004, indicated that these advocacy groups already felt that they had lost on U.S. campuses, which had been won over by pro-Palestinian advocacy, notwithstanding their previously flourishing propaganda efforts. A growing disenchantment with Israel among liberal young American Jews, including college students, was the main burden of a remarkable article by Peter Beinart in the June 10, 2010 issue of the New York Review of Books. Now, I think that Beinart may stress or overstress the decline of support for Israel on some campuses. He may exaggerate it. But I think that something does appear to be happening on campuses, given this broader change in views of the Palestinians, given this greater availability of literature, both academic and non-academic, when one compares things now with the situation a few decades ago. It certainly has changed, I think. I think this is a function of the accessibility of alternative information and news via the internet, which enables young people to compile their own view of the world. If they rely on the mainstream media, frankly, they're not going to have a different view than their parents or their grandparents, because the mainstream media still repeats pretty much every single tired, worn-out, useless myth that they've been repeating for the past several decades where basic issues are concerned. That's not true of the alternative media. Young people in particular are able to rely on sources that sometimes are closer to events than the mainstream media, stuff that's published in the region, whether in Hebrew or Arabic, or translated, and usually translated into English, whether blogs, whether looking at raw footage on YouTube, whether looking at satellite TV stations or their websites that emanate from the Middle East and provide language, all kinds of information that simply is not available in the mainstream media. You could see this over the assault on the Turkish ship Mavi Marmara in May. The mainstream media tended very much, and our political system entirely tended, to repeat the Israeli point of view. Anywhere else in the alternative media, you could see all kinds of points of view, the Israeli point of view, the Turkish point, all kinds of points of view. In the face of this new landscape, the Israel advocacy establishment has mounted a number of initiatives. These have included redoubling efforts to positively brand Israel for college students, expensive, very expensive programs to send even more young people to Israel, and the establishment of numerous Israel studies programs and Israel chairs on U.S. campuses. At the same time, there's been an increase in attempts to exert external pressure on American universities and on campuses involving the mobilization of the media or of alumni or of off-campus organizations and of cooperative local politicians. At Columbia, we had all of the above. We had a rainstorm of such stuff over the past 7 or 8 years. At many universities, these pressures have thus far been successfully resisted. Pressures on the tenure process, on the appointment process, pressure on what's taught, and so forth. At other universities, however, administrators have caved in when confronted with the attack dog methods of their critics. The record shows that administrators will often not stand up to such powerful outside forces on their own, but that they may feel obliged to do so if faculty and students insist on academic freedom, on faculty responsibility for the curriculum and for the promotion and tenure process, and on the insulation of the university from external influences. Now, I began by suggesting that the realm of ideas was a major battlefield for those who were seeking to establish the Zionist project in Palestine in the first half of the century, and that success in this endeavor was crucial to the success of this project in the second half of the 20th century. It's obviously too early to tell whether as a result of the new diversity of opinions that's available in the public sphere regarding Palestine and Israel, there will be a lessening of the intellectual hegemony that a narrow pro-Israel perspective has achieved and maintained for most of the past few decades. Certainly, I would argue, the growing availability of entirely new interpretations than were once available means that Americans, at least Americans who have the ability to read books and articles and go beyond the mainstream media, Americans can at last make up their own minds and are no longer only restricted to one tendentious, stridently pro-Israel interpretation of the situation in Palestine and Israel, as was the case in the past. Now, I think there's reason for deep short-term pessimism about the political process that determines American Middle East policy, about the kinds of irresponsible positions that are taken by Congress, and about the policies of administration after administration. There's reason for pessimism about the mainstream media and how it covers this conflict. And there's deep pessimism about the grim situation in Palestine and in Israel. Nevertheless, I have argued, and I would argue, that there are encouraging positive trends in this country. It took generations to establish the myths that enabled Israel not only to be successful, but to establish a very strong position in American public opinion, and it'll take a very long time to deconstruct those myths. If we want these changes to continue, a lot of work is necessary to confront old prejudices and myths, to overcome fears of intimidation by those who are fighting to maintain the status quo, and to do this in a way that doesn't offend people, because these are related to deeply important questions of identity, these issues I've talked about. It may be a long time before we can expect a really transformative change in this status quo. But I think that something is beginning to show through the screen that's thrown up by the media. I think that the system of domination and control over the Palestinians through the calculated use of violence that has obtained in the occupied territories for 43 years and that has maintained the dispossession of those Palestinians who lost their homes 62 years ago cannot be hidden forever. It is a system of domination and control through violence. Anybody who spends any time looking at all sides of it can see this, and I don't think it's possible to maintain the fiction that that's not the basic situation. The brilliantly conceived discursive artifice that has concealed this tragic situation for so long is crumbling slowly but surely. And I think it's crumbling with the young people much quicker than I would have expected. It won't perhaps so quickly with people who are older. Given the acknowledgement by far-sighted Israeli leaders such as former Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert that continuation of the status quo in Israel and Palestine will lead inevitably to apartheid and possibly worse. These are their words, not my words. This is Prime Minister Olmert speaking to Haaretz in December 2007, and this is Ehud Barak at that point, then and now, defense minister, speaking to The Guardian in February of 2010. The fact that far-sighted Israelis see this, the day is nearing when the status quo will pass. Maybe it's not nearing in the sense of it being tomorrow, but it will come. I think it's up to Israelis and Palestinians themselves, in the first instance, to dismantle this iniquitous system and to put in place one that is more just. I have no idea what that system would be. I'm described in some handout that was given to you as an advocate of the one-state solution. I'm no more an advocate of that than I'm an advocate of the two-state solution. I don't think either of them is a very easy thing to implement. But I can tell you for sure that the status quo is not just, and the status quo will change sooner or later. It's not stable. That in the first instance is really not up to us, but up to people there to change that and put into place something that's better. But Americans bear a heavy responsibility in this affair, too. It has been the United States that has upheld this entire discriminatory structure since 1948. A beginning in changing this has already begun, and I would suggest that it is absolutely necessary that even though we are in the secondary position as citizens of a country that's very far away, we are citizens of a country that's very powerful, has an enormous impact over there, and it's up to us to do something as well, even if the primary responsibility resides on people who actually live there. I would argue that true peace with justice in Palestine and in Israel for the two peoples that live there depends entirely on the continuation of this process. Thank you very much. Thank you. I have been asked for the sake of the recording to repeat your questions, so please do make them questions, because if you give a speech, I can't repeat it, much as I would like to, perhaps. So I'd be happy to take questions. From students first. How about that? Anybody who's, and I don't mean permanent students, we're all permanent students. I mean actual Franklin and Marshall or other students. So questions. Yes, you look like a student.
Thanks for coming.
Pleasure.
Mm-hmm. And you've been on a search committee for an Israel chair, so can't often the money coming from can't that kind of influence who's hired?
Can't that influence?
Who's hired as a professor?
Right. The question is, I talked about the Israel lobby. I actually didn't use the word Israel lobby. I quoted the Mearsheimer book, and I've mentioned Israel studies. And the questioner said that there's been a huge amount of money given by Saudi Arabia or by Saudis for the founding of chairs or whatever. And can't that money influence the hiring? Is that the question, basically? Well, one of the things universities try and do is to insulate what they do from the people who give the money. And they do a better or worse job of that. Universities don't like to believe that they basically hire whoever the donor wants. And I think that it's been shown in the donations given by Saudi Arabia to some universities, or in the donations given by people who've established chairs of Israel studies or Israel studies programs, that quite frequently the people that they hire are not entirely to the liking of the donors. So yes, to some extent you could argue big donations can shape a university towards doing more in a certain direction. I would say that's true. I would say that if you didn't have donors who were willing to give money for Israel studies, you might not have as robust a new field of Israel studies. But if you actually look at the Israel Studies Association and you look at the people who are hired, especially the Israelis who are hired for these chairs, they generally are not writing things that some of these donors are terribly happy with. I've seen this in case after case. There are people who, you know, write what they want. If an Arab government gave money to the chair I'm sitting in, I'm the holder of the Edward Said chair, and they read the kinds of things I say about Arab governments, they're probably not very happy with the things I say about Arab kleptocracies and the absence of democracy in the Arab world and so on and so forth, or the corrupting nature of the security relationship between the United States and governments like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And so I think that it's true that to some extent these kinds of donations can help to define, broadly speaking, a program, or some of the directions a university might go in. But one of the things that faculty will be insistent on in hiring, or should be insisted on, and if it's not, they're derelict in their duty, is hiring people who are the best possible people, irrespective of their politics. And I know that this has been the case in some of these kinds of chairs you're talking about, both those established with money for Israel studies and those established with money for from the Saudis or other Arab donors, that they're not always happy with the people who are hired or with the people who end up in those positions. Another student, a couple more students, and then non-students. Yes?
You talked extensively about the changing American perspectives about Israel, the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Right. Right. That's a good question. I talked about the change in American views on Israel and Palestine, or Palestine and Israel. How do I explain the quite different views in Europe? Well, you know, there's several things in Europe that are different. For one thing, Europeans are a lot more racist and discriminatory in their treatment of immigrant communities than we are. We have problems, God knows, in that respect. But actually, this country does a lot better than any European country I know. And I spend a lot of time in Europe in dealing with immigrant issues. And it's partly because in Europe they're related to colonial issues. I mean, the Algerian and Muslim and Senegalese presence in France is a function of the British colonial empire. The South Asian and Caribbean and African presence in Britain, similarly, and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, you are right. In Europe, there is quite a different view of Arab-Israeli issues. And I think that this can be ascribed basically to the fact that there's a much higher level of discourse in those countries and a greater level of knowledge and a lower level of ignorance about these things. I mean, if you look at the debates in France between supporters of Israel and supporters of the Palestinians, they're on a completely different level. I mean, we hardly have debates in this country. It's a one-sided argument. Maybe on campuses we have debates, but in the public forum there is no debate. But there is a debate in France, and it's on a much higher level. Both sides are talking, to some extent, from a fact base, rather than from a myth base on one side and on a whatever base on the other. So the public is more knowledgeable about the Middle East. These are countries that have colonial pasts or had an interaction. Germany had an interaction with the Middle East. There were German settlers in Palestine. Germany, under both the Nazis and under the Wilhelmine regime, before and during World War I, had a major Near Eastern presence. And so people know. They've traveled. Americans are much less knowledgeable about the Middle East. Most of what they think they know either from a religious background, reading the Bible. This is as true of Christians as it is of Jews or Muslims. Or, not, in particular, those who've never been there. And even some of those who've been there, they've been on what I would call magical mystery tours, i.e. they're led around by people who show them exactly what, you know, they're intended to see. And that's all they do see. Europeans travel in the Middle East, and they vacation in Tunisia or Morocco. And so while they may have racist attitudes at home, they know something about some of these countries. They've also fought there. I mean, there were armies and armies and armies of Europeans, whether in colonial wars or in World War II, in the Middle East. So for a variety of reasons, the level of discourse in Europe is, in fact, higher. I think that's particularly the case in those countries that have the closest relationship. So Britain, France, to some extent Spain, Portugal, they're closer. Greece. Another question. Yes, sir.
Can you tell us a little about the rights of homosexuals and Jews and other minorities in the Gaza Strip?
I wonder where you got that question. Well, first of all, as you probably know, if the people who gave you that handout have given you any kind of background, all Israeli settlers were withdrawn from the Gaza Strip, so there are no Jews, except Israeli army patrols that enter, patrol, or bomb, or otherwise may happen to be present in Gaza. Homosexuals don't have very many rights in Gaza. It's a repressive Islamic regime. Women don't have many rights in Gaza. In fact, anybody who's not a supporter of Hamas at the moment doesn't have very many rights in Gaza. It's an oppressive regime. There's an oppressive regime in the West Bank, but it's more liberal in terms of public morality. It's more repressive in terms of its political opponents and less repressive in terms of political morality. But as you know, there's no Jewish population in the Gaza Strip, so that part of your question, you should have told the people who gave you the question to remove it because it's dumb. But that's okay. Any other questions? Yes. Okay, you're not a student, but go ahead. I think what it tells us is what 43 years of occupation will do. What it tells us is that if you treat people like animals, you're going to get a ferocious response. And that's what Gaza has been That's how Gaza has been treated over 43 years. I'm no fan of Hamas myself. I'm an opponent of their political line. I'm an opponent of the way they use violence. I think that the regime they've instituted in Gaza is a terrible one. But I'm afraid that if you look at the history of Hamas, it's a subject on which there actually is some good scholarly writing. And if you're really interested in Hamas, I can recommend some sources to you, some of them by Israeli authors, which show, first of all, how the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the organization out of which Hamas grew, was the coddled darling of the Israeli military occupation up to 1987 when Hamas was founded and even afterwards, because it was seen as a rival to the secular nationalist PLO, which was perceived as the main danger. The Israelis allowed Hamas thugs to be bussed through Israel to the West Bank to break up PLO demonstrations. They allowed them to trash the Palestine Red Crescent offices in Gaza affiliated with the PLO. And when Hamas turned to violence, Israel was astonished at first. But in fact, the undermining and the sabotage of the nationalist secular PLO almost inevitably opened the field for the creation of Hamas. So did other factors. The way in which Gaza has been treated throughout the occupation, but in particular in the last 10 or 15 years, has increased the ferocity of the behavior of Hamas. So I don't think that the answer to your question is they behave like a bunch of animals, therefore they don't deserve a state. People have a natural right to self-determination. The problem here is what has been done to Gaza. I think it's really well worth looking at what has been done to Gaza, in particular in the last few years. It is actually, in the words of jurists who I think know what they're talking about, in some form a crime against humanity. Things have been done in Gaza in terms of punishing the civilian population for the sins of its rulers that are impermissible, that just cannot and should not be done. Country has a right to self-defense. That does not mean punishing the entire civilian population. Any country has the right of self-defense. I think that what has been done in Gaza, interestingly enough, Hamas, you may or may not have noticed, over many months now has managed to maintain a ceasefire. And why this is the case, I don't know. I think what it shows is that their use of violence is tactical. That's one reason Palestinians are opposed to it. They realize that it's cynical, that it has nothing to do with principle, as Hamas argues. It is essentially something that they use to increase their support among Palestinians. And one reason that they're not using violence is because many Palestinians have turned away from that approach. They realize that that use of violence is counterproductive. I think that's actually a good thing. But I don't think it tells you, I think it also tells you something about the fact that the leaders of Hamas are really just politicians. They're not evil, insane, barbaric terrorists who just want to kill. It's a lot more complicated than that. I don't see any more students, so I'll call on you, sir. Oh, you're pointing to another student?
Yeah, student up here.
Another student. Okay, yes, go ahead. Sorry. I apologize. I'll get back to you.
467, like living under Jordanian and Egyptian rule, living in a refugee camp, how would you describe it? Like, why did Palestine didn't ask for a country then? Why did it fight?
Right. Right. The question was, before 1967, where Palestinians were living in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip under respectively Jordanian and Egyptian military administration, Jordanian rule and Egyptian military administration, why didn't Palestinians seek independence or fight for self-rule? Some were in refugee camps, some weren't. In the Gaza Strip, most people were in refugee camps. In the West Bank, majority of the population never was in refugee camps. Remember, the West Bank was part of Palestine that wasn't ethnically cleansed, so people came there, and some of them who arrived ended up in refugee camps, but there was a large part of the population that never moved. The population of Nablus, Jenin, Ramallah, Khalil, and so on, they were not in refugee camps. It's a good question, actually, and if you look at the history of Palestinian nationalism, you will see that both the Egyptians and the Jordanians severely repressed any attempt by the Palestinians to organize themselves. The Jordanian secret police were extremely active, and the Palestinians were forced to organize in places very far away, either in Lebanon or in Kuwait or in Saudi Arabia or in Algeria, because the governments immediately around Palestine and Israel, by and large, were not sympathetic to Palestinian nationalism, in particular the Jordanian government, but also the Egyptian military administration. If you read Abu Jihad's and Yasser Arafat's accounts in books like Eric Rouleau's book on Abu Iyad, the Hart biography of Arafat, they talk about how their first experiences were in Egyptian prisons, where the Egyptians threw them in jail for Palestinian activism. So the reason was not because the Palestinians were not motivated in the 50s or the early 60s, but rather because those were governments that opposed what they did. Another student, yes. Parties where?
So, like Hamas and Hezbollah, for example.
Well, Hezbollah is not a Palestinian party. It's a Lebanese party. Let me repeat the question. How do I see the role of political parties in, I presume you mean on the Arab side?
On both sides.
On both sides in bringing about a resolution to this conflict. Let me talk about the Palestinian side first. Hezbollah, Lebanese party, I'll talk about it in a minute. I actually think both leading Palestinian political formations are pretty much strategically bankrupt. They have very few good ideas about what can be done to improve the situation of the Palestinians and to move them from a situation where they're totally under Israeli control or in the diaspora without control over their lives to a situation where one way or another they obtain rights and have control over their lives. Hamas has argued that resistance is the path, and I think people have seen, Palestinians have seen, where that leads. It led to 1,400 Palestinians, most of them civilians, being killed to no good purpose in December and January of 2008-2009. And it is not a strategy. It's basically a tactic to increase Hamas's popularity, and it's failed even at that. So they don't have a strategy. And Fatah, which dominates the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, similarly doesn't have much of a strategy. All they argue for is negotiation. Well, it's fine to negotiate, but you have to have a unified public opinion, a consensus on a negotiating position, which we don't have. The Palestinians are divided. What we see is one Palestinian faction dominating one part of the occupied territories, the West Bank, and another dominating the other. And finally, you have to be in a position to exert some kind of leverage in a situation where you're relatively weak. You have to figure out a way to develop leverage. And they don't have any sense of doing that, of mobilizing their people, of appealing to public opinion. Israelis talk about how there's a campaign to delegitimize Israel. They talk about the enormous effect of pro-Palestinian activism. I promise you, this is not thanks, whatever there is not thanks to the efforts either of Hamas or the PA. They are inept and incompetent. They have no sense. They have no vision. They have no strategic idea of how to move. So the Palestinians are really in a terrible position in having very, very, very weak political leadership on both sides, in my view. Israel is a problem in a different way. The Israeli public is so satisfied with the status quo in terms of its living conditions. I mean, Israel has a GDP per capita that puts it in the top half of European countries, if it were in Europe, obviously. It's a relatively prosperous country by comparison with five-sixths of the rest of the world. It's a country that's insulated from the conflict in many respects. All Israeli young people are drafted. They are forced to serve. They serve in the occupied territories. Other Israelis don't see it. There are bypass roads, there are walls, there are fences. It's out of their consciousness. 12 minutes away, 2 minutes away, it could as well be an ocean away. So they don't, unless rockets come over, unless there's an outbreak of violence, which happens from time to time, as much as possible they ignore it. And in that context, Israeli politics are moving further and further to the right, moving away from the idea of the vital nature of a resolution of this conflict to assumption that this is a conflict that can only be managed. You can't resolve it. Back in the 90s, most Israelis thought there was a chance to solve this conflict. That doesn't seem to be the case now. And there are many Israelis who feel differently. But they're a minority in Israel, and there's not much in the way of political representation of them. As far as Hezbollah is a Lebanese party. I mean, it's directly involved in Lebanese politics. It has a big impact on this conflict. It has had a huge impact at different times on this conflict. But it's actually not as directly involved any more than any other Arab party or Arab government is in the Palestinian-Israeli aspect of things. So I think that one of the problems is that the situation looks really bleak in terms of both the situation on the Palestinian side and the situation on the Israeli side. It's not terribly encouraging. You had a question behind, yeah.
Formulate policy on the Middle East. Any time that the president, for example, any time the administration not to respect adequately security concerns for Israel. There's an uprise in the Senate. Letters are sent to the president.
Mm-hmm.
And all these promises of secretaries of state and peace conferences and the administration, successive administrations, come to naught because they're tied up in Congress.
Okay, the question, it's hard to summarize that question, but what would I say the questioner asks about the problem that presidents face anytime that they try and take a position that doesn't take sufficient account of the security concerns of Israel, at which point they face an uproar in Congress, supposedly don't take into account. Well, I mean, this is a problem that clearly this administration and the first Bush administration and the Carter administration all faced. Because unlike the administration of President George W. Bush or the presidency of Ronald Reagan, in which there were no serious efforts to resolve this conflict, each of those three presidents at least started out, President Bush Sr., President Carter, President Obama, started out talking as if they wanted to do something to resolve this conflict. And in each case, you're right, they did run into a great deal of opposition. And I think what it means is that any president who wants to do this is going to have to expend some political capital on explaining why this is vital to American national interests, on explaining why this is vital to Israel, and on explaining why some of what is being argued is fanciful nonsense, and that whether it's an argument about Israel's security being threatened by certain moves towards peace or other things, basically this is wrong. It's a difficult thing to do in the current environment, and I don't just mean after the 2010 elections. I mean, given the rightward drift in Israeli politics, because it's very hard to find any kind of support within an Israeli government for any kind of move to change the status quo. That wasn't the case in the 90s. There was an Israeli government that had at least some sense. Actually, from the first Intifada onward, from the late 80s onward, Israeli public opinion was increasingly convinced of the need, the necessity to change the status quo. That's just not the case now. So it's a particularly different thing. And in this country, we have people who, many of whom, just don't think for themselves. They don't look at the situation. They don't go and look and really see the situation. Maybe this is not such a good situation. They tend to support the status quo and to argue against any change in it. That's less true with young people. The problem is young people don't vote. The problem is young people are, you know, not yet in positions of influence and power in this society. If they continue to have an open-minded view, then that may change, but it'll be two or three administrations from now, and heaven knows what kind of damage will be done over there in the interim. You already had a question. I'll get back to you, though, maybe. Yeah.
What's the institutional role these days in Palestinian politics of the PLO as such? And is there any articulation whatsoever between what PA is doing in terms of negotiations and diaspora Palestinians?
Yeah. That's a good question. The question was, is there any, what is the role of the PLO itself, the Palestine Liberation Organization? And is there any articulation between the PA and the Palestinians in the diaspora, whether in the Arab countries or elsewhere? That's actually a very interesting question. You know, the party that negotiated all the agreements with Israel was not the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was created by those agreements. But the Palestinian Authority, by Israeli decision, it was the Israelis who decided this, was to be no more than a self-governing authority for the occupied territories. It was elected by the people in the occupied territories, including Jerusalem. Israel grudgingly accepted that, occupied Arab East Jerusalem, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But it does not represent, and was not meant to represent, other Palestinians. And it's not a sovereign body. It's not a state. It's a self-governing authority. Negotiations with Israel are supposed to take place with the PLO, which Rabin recognized in 1993 as the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, as most countries in the world had already recognized it by that point. And so there is actually no direct articulation, nor is there actually supposed to be by the treaties with Israel, that in fact some of them are trilateral, treaties with Israel and the United States, establishing the Palestinian Authority. The PLO is actually moribund, and it's been moribund more or less since Arafat and his colleagues moved into the occupied territories in 94-95. They basically abandoned the population outside. They basically left those organs of the PLO that supposedly represent all Palestinians, both those under occupation and those in other Arab countries. And they have atrophied pretty much in the decade and a half since then, which is a serious problem because there's no body representing all Palestinians. There's nobody paying attention to really crucial, critical crisis situations like the situation of Palestinians in Lebanon, which is much ignored. People pay a lot of attention to Palestinians under occupation. They pay very little attention to the really grim situation of Palestinians in Lebanon, and that's the responsibility of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO. It's not the responsibility of the PA. PA is a self-governing organization. Pretty much the ideas that Begin put forward at the first Camp David in the 1970s, that's what Oslo created. Created structures for self-government of Palestinians under a continuing umbrella of Israeli sovereignty, jurisdiction, and security control. That's what we have to this day. 16, 17 years of the PA notwithstanding. But it in fact has fragmented further Palestinian politics, the existence of the PA, for the reasons I've just said. Yes?
Have you reconciled your claim that the...
Had I what? I didn't hear a word.
Reconcile
my claim, yeah.
Reconcile, I guess, yeah. Your claim that the discriminatory structure within Israel, that there's a discriminatory structure within Israel, with the fact that there are, that Israeli Arabs have the full bit of privileges, that there are currently 14 members of, Arab members of the Israeli parliament.
Right. How do I reconcile my claim that there's a discriminatory structure in Israel with the fact that there are Arabs, Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel have full voting rights and there are currently 14 Arab members of the Israeli Knesset? I can reconcile that very easily. Look at the laws of the State of Israel. Most of the land of Israel, most of the land in Israel, is land confiscated from its Arab owners right after 1948, taken over either by the Keren Kayemet Israel, the Jewish National Fund, or the Israel Lands Authority, and by charter of those bodies, restricted to Jews only. So you have legal discrimination in terms of land, almost all of which is actually Arab-owned, or was Arab-owned, such that only Jews can use it. Now, if we had those kinds of restricted covenants in this country, which we did before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that would be called racist. If I say the word racist about Israel, somebody's going to distribute a leaflet about me saying I used the word racist about Israel. I just described to you the legal structure which dominates almost all land in Israel. The overwhelming majority of land in the country is controlled by that structure. Most Arabs do not serve in the Israeli army. A few do. Bedouin, Druze, some Christians. A few others serve in the border guard, and some serve in the police. Otherwise, none of them serve in the security services. They're not allowed to serve in the security services of the army, and so on and so forth. Most privileges in Israel, in terms of loans, access to certain kinds of jobs, are keyed to military service. Okay? Many people don't do military service who are religious, and they're exempt from both those privileges and from that service. But Arabs who can't do service are, in effect, barred by law from all kinds of things. Now, I would point you also to the educational system. It's what you might call separate but unequal. I would point you to the municipalities. It's what you might call separate but unequal. Look at the amount of money spent on a municipality like Umm al-Fahm or a municipality like Nazareth or any one of the Arab municipalities in Israel, and look at the money spent on any Jewish municipality. And that's the way it is. It is a segregated society. The educational systems are completely separate. Little Arab boys and girls do not go to school with little Jewish boys and girls. They go to separate schools. They study under the same system. They all do the Bagrut. They all learn Hebrew. They all sing HaTikvah. They all learn about the prophets and Jewish history and Israel and Zionism and the founders of the state. They all learn the same curriculum. Some learn in an Arab school. Some learn in a Jewish school. So it's a highly segregated and highly unequally segregated society in terms of the money spent on those separate systems. There are some systems that are integrated. The medical system actually is integrated, and half the doctors almost are Arab. But anything to do with security, which is to say most of the high-tech industries in Israel or defense, and anything to do with government, where there's a minuscule proportion of Arabs, except as, you know, concierges and handymen, are highly segregated. So I don't see any contradiction. And I would suggest that you look at read the Israeli press and see what Israeli lawmakers in the parties that dominate the current coalition are trying to do in terms of restricting rights of Arabs and how they're talking about expelling citizens of the country from the country. The kind of talk that got Kahani ostracized from the Knesset is the talk of the leader of the second largest party in the governing coalition, Avigdor Lieberman. So, I mean, I don't see any difficulty reconciling those things. That they're both true. All citizens of Israel enjoy the protection of the law. All citizens of Israel vote. That's true of Arabs and Jews. But there are all kinds of discriminatory structures in place, like the ones I've described to you. Other questions? Yes, sir, you with the mustache. You with the glasses. I am. Dude in the yellow shirt. I don't know. How American public opinion
gets formed.
Okay.
And on the one side, you say Americans are incredibly ignorant and they just don't know very much. And on the other side, you
I didn't actually say that. Anyway.
On the other side, you seem to say that there's this incredible growth of opportunities, especially for the younger generation, for people to go out and form.
Right. Right.
And the reason why I want to ask you about that is because I want you to sort of game out what the possible shifts in American public opinion coming down the pipe might be.
Okay.
And
let me.
In particular, I'm interested in one, which is.
I'm going to have to repeat all of this, you know. Anyway, go ahead. One, which is.
Which is, this might be coming from Bayern, it might be coming from somewhere else. Not that people would suddenly become interested in learning the facts.
Right.
But that they might just sort of lose interest in the conflict and American and cease to support for Israel as not an ally, which is wither.
And support for Israel?
As an ally, but simply wither.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't defined as a national security.
Okay. I don't think I can repeat all of that, to tell you the honest truth. But I'll try and repeat some of it. What the questioner said is there seems to be a disconnect in what I'm saying between my description of Americans, he said, as ignorant. I didn't actually say that. And between my description of a growing interest of and ability to look at alternate sources of information by young people. And the final part of your question, I'm not sure I understood, but what you're trying to say is, might that lead to apathy? Is that what you're saying? Or might that lead to a withering of support for Israel? Okay, and what makes me think that future American public opinion will be more based on an objective view? Well, I don't know. I mean, when I'm asked that kind of question, I fall back on a cheap retort, which is, I'm a historian by training, and the job description of a historian doesn't include predicting the future. I don't know where anything's going to lead. I can tell you where it seems we've gotten to and what that might mean about the present, and I may be wrong about the present. I hope I'm right about the past. And I do think that there was a great deal of misinformation in this country and a great lack of knowledge. And I think that that's changed with younger people. I mean, I say this not just about Palestine, Israel, or the Middle East. Talk to anybody involved in higher education and ask them, how many more students are interested in international studies? How many more students want to study languages? How many more students want to go abroad? There's been an explosion on every campus I've been to, and I go to a lot over the past 10 or 20 years. So, whereas Americans tended to be more isolated and isolationist and people didn't travel internationally as much, we're far away from the rest of the world. You know, Europe, you fall out of bed and you're in Belgium and you roll over and you're in Luxembourg. It's small countries close to each other. I mean, from someplace in the south of France, you can be in Italy in 4 hours and in Spain in 3 hours. You know, so they're small countries and people know what's going on next door, partly because they were always invading one another. So they had to know, okay? Americans never had any fear, existential fear, since the British burned Washington in 1812. No fear. Yes, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Most people don't even know where Pearl Harbor is. It's very far away. It's an ocean away. They didn't bomb San Francisco. They bombed Pearl Harbor. The Cold War was an existential threat, and a real existential threat. But with that exception, the United States has never had to fear anybody. So we don't pay attention to other countries. We don't learn languages. We're monoglot. We have a certain ability not to have to look abroad that everybody else does. I'm arguing that that's changing. I don't think that's ignorance. That's just a function of the historical position of the United States in the world over two centuries, from its founding until now. And I'm simply suggesting that younger people in universities, the kind of people I know about from talking to administrators and faculty members and students, are more interested in the world generally, much more interested in the world. That doesn't mean every student is interested in the world. That doesn't mean that, you know, nobody who's over 40 is not. I'm just saying those are the trends. Now, I don't know where those trends would lead as far as this issue is concerned. I had a discussion with Peter Beinart the other day. He said, you know, there are other important trends. There's an increase among the Orthodox of a really militant kind of Zionism, and these people are deeply concerned about Israel. They're very, very hawkish, and they may come to dominate the discourse because other people who are more secular in the Jewish community will just stop being that interested in Israel. That may happen. I don't know. I don't know what the way in which things might go in the future. There is an increase, it seems, and this is not something that's true of the Jewish community or it's true generally, of a sense among policymakers and others that actually Israel is not the enormous strategic asset that it was perceived to be starting in the 60s and through the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And that, in fact, what General Petraeus and Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates and Vice President Biden and President Obama have all said in different ways is that if this conflict isn't solved, this is a huge liability for the United States, and the implication is Israel is a liability for the United States. That's the unspoken undertext of what at least some of them were saying. And Petraeus, in some of his remarks, apparently said this more or less bluntly. Vice President Biden apparently said this to Prime Minister Netanyahu very bluntly back in the spring. And there's no question that any American, and it is the case that you have tens of thousands of American officers who are spending their careers in the Middle East and are figuring out that this is actually an issue that's important to the Middle Easterners, among whom we live, and if they're not, they don't like us, might shoot at us. And so it's important to my life and important to my career and important to the national interest that I bring this to the attention of people in Washington who are being brainwashed by the Washington Institute and a bunch of other people into believing that actually the Arabs don't care about Palestine. Which is true of the governments, but is not true of public opinion. The governments, in fact, have done nothing, or very little, and much of what they've done has been harmful as far as the Palestine issue is concerned. But public opinion actually is quite exercised about Palestine. As you can see, anytime there's an upsurge, and you just can spend 20 minutes surfing Al Jazeera or any other TV station, Arabiya or BBC or anyone you like, and you'll see that people are actually quite concerned about that. So it could be that over time, these people who are serving this country abroad in this region are going to bring home to Washington a sense that, yes, we have to solve this, and yes, the United States is suffering as a result of its connection with Israel, and so, yes, this is in the vital national interest of the United States, but maybe not. I mean, the consensus in Washington is rock solid, and it's not reality-based. It's in another place. And it's dominated by policymakers who are much more worried about what will be the political impact of our taking this position domestically, rather than what is in the national security interest of the United States. So I don't know what's going to happen. I have no crystal ball. Yes, sir. The question was, would most countries in the Middle East like to see a peaceful resolution of the conflict? Most countries in the Middle East would like to see nothing more than see this thing taken away from them. It has been exploited by some of these countries in the past. It's actually currently exploited by Iran and by some others. But most regimes in the Middle East find this an embarrassment to them because they have a security relationship with the United States, which is called into question by their opposition because of American support for Israel. So the overwhelming interest of countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt that are aligned, and Jordan and so on, that are very closely aligned with the United States, is to solve this thing and get it off the plate, which is why Secretary Baker, under the first President Bush, was able to get every single Arab country to multilateral meetings with the Israelis when it looked like Israel and the Palestinians were going to resolve the bilateral aspects of the conflict between them. All the other Arab countries were perfectly willing to move towards normalization because they thought, it's over, it's solved, thank God, now we can get on with other business, like making money and stealing from our people and whatever these governments do. And that has not happened, for reasons we all may know, but I don't think it's any less the case today than it was in 1993-94 at the Madrid Peace Conference or in the various multilateral meetings that took place when most Arab countries developed one form or another of relationship with Israel. I think that shows you where they're, you know, if they had their druthers, what they would do. Yes, sir.
Size of population, size of land,
Question is, could I say a little more about Gaza? Gaza has 1.6 million people. It's an area of, I think, 27 square miles. It's a very, very small area. It's one of the most heavily populated areas in the world. It's the only Palestinian community which is majority refugee, still living in refugee camps. Now, the majority of the Palestinian population in Jordan or Syria are of refugee origin. That is to say, they were refugees in 48, or some of them came over in 67. But almost in both of those countries, most of those people have moved out of the camps. So they may be of refugee origin, but they're no longer living in refugee camps. Gaza has a majority refugee population, most of whom still live in refugee camps, because it's a little tiny territory. When the Egyptians controlled it, they rigorously prevented Gazans from leaving for Egypt. You know, they could go out for education or travel, but they didn't want them to settle in Egypt. Okay? Since Israel has ruled it since 67, there's been something of the same kind of policy. For a while, they allowed people to go to the West Bank. They allowed many people to work in Israel, but they had to go back to the Gaza Strip. Hundreds of thousands of Gazans used to work in Israel up until the first Intifada, for the first 20 years, in other words, of the occupation. And that brought a certain kind of prosperity. As Sarah Roy has argued, it was dependency. It involved the undermining of the possibility of independent economic development in Gaza, but at least people had wages and were able to survive comfortably. Ever since the closures and the systematic sealing of Gaza, which started with the first Intifada and became systematic and complete with the second Intifada starting in 2000, Gaza is can be seen as the world's largest open-air prison camp. Both the Egyptians on their side and Israel on the other two sides and from the sea basically prevent anything from going in or out unless they vet it. And they've prevented people from going in and out, Israel and Egypt, for the better part of a couple of years now, really since Hamas took over the Gaza Strip in July 2007. There is no starvation in Gaza. There are more than enough calories per capita for people to live. But it's the way they live. It's their absolute absence of freedom of movement. It's the absolute lack of a horizon, of an ability to think of a future. There's a student who came to see me yesterday. He's at a Seeds of Peace exchange program with five Israelis, five Palestinians come to NYU. And he worked in a UN-supported some kind of thing with kids. And he asked 14 kids, can you visualize the future? What would it be like in 20 years? And every one of the 14 kids said, al-qabr, the grave. They can't foresee, they don't have a future. They can't get out, they can't get jobs, they can't get educated. They're locked in this prison. I mean, they can move from the refugee camp down the street and up and down, but essentially it's a life with no hope, no future. So it's pretty grim. It's not starvation. It's not, you know, the number of calories needed to sustain human life is allowed to enter. But what would be necessary to resuscitate that economy and what would be necessary to allow people to get out for an education or for treatment or for whatever is just not allowed either by the Egyptians or, most importantly, by the Israelis. And Israel is still the occupying authority. Israel withdrew its troops, withdrew its settlers under Sharon in 2005. But, in fact, under international law, Israel is still the occupying power. It still controls Gaza. So it has the obligation to allow these people freedom of movement, which it's not keeping. Egypt is the bordering power. It has the obligation to allow those people to let out. Obviously, both have the right to protect their own security, but that does not include locking people up in an open-air prison, which is their situation today. Yes, sir.
You may suspect that I disagree with a lot of what you said tonight.
I don't suspect anything.
Just a few quick questions.
Mm-hmm.
I have trouble summarizing them.
Why don't you give me one or two, and then maybe we'll come back for one or two more.
Follow-ups from all the other questions.
Okay, I'll try. I'll do my best. No.
Would you say that Israel is the least racist area in the Middle East?
Least racist area in the Middle East. I would have no idea how to make that judgment.
Taking into consideration the fact that there are members of the Knesset that are Arabs.
Right.
There are limited rights for what Arabs are allowed in Israel. Would you be able to make that concession?
I would make a statement, which is that if you were to offer Palestinians in Israel the opportunity to leave and live in a Palestinian state governed like the PA in Ramallah governs or like Hamas governs, they wouldn't leave. They would much prefer to live under the discriminatory regime, but with the rights they have in Israel, than to live in a regime where they wouldn't be discriminated against ethnically, but where they wouldn't have those political rights or the social services network that they have in Israel. Moreover, they would stay because they think it's their home, but they don't want to go for other reasons. Now, I don't know how I would compare with other countries in the region. I mean, you have a country like Turkey where you had a genocide take place against the Armenians. So it was ethnically cleansed, more or less the way most of Israel was ethnically cleansed of most of its Arab population in 1948, but much more systematically and with massacres and murder. Palestinians weren't massacred. There were massacres. A few thousand people were killed. We're talking about 1 million Armenians killed in 1915. But today, Turkey is a democratic country. Now, there are huge flaws in that, the treatment of Kurds. How do you compare that to Israel? The history is so different. How do you compare a country like, I don't know, Egypt, where you have a huge Coptic population, and the Copts feel discriminated against, but they're Egyptians, and Copts have served in Egyptian governments or been leaders of whatever. So I don't know how I would compare them.
One more question, because it appears to be longer than
yeah. I didn't repeat your question, but that's okay. Entertaining. First time I've ever described entertaining. Thank you. Yeah.
So I want to thank you for that. You've definitely given me food for thought. And, my question is really from a historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that the American community population was kind of influenced by the PR.
Right.
Maybe not on purpose, but that's the way the story was told. How do you reconcile that with the initial resistance of the American, or of many Jews in America, in the creation of the state?
That's a good question. I'll try and repeat that. The questioner said, Rabbi said, I described the way in which propaganda or a narrative supportive of Zionism won over Americans. How do I reconcile that with the fact that many American Jews were not supportive of Zionism? Is that the basic question you're asking? That's a good question. It's an interesting question if you look not only at the United States, but also at France and Great Britain, where you had significant opposition in the Jewish communities of each of these three countries to Zionism, not only from religious Jews, many of whom felt that it was impious or even sacrilegious to try and for man to bring about the return of the people of Israel to Israel, but also from assimilated secular Jews who felt that Zionism threatened their position, their assimilated position, in the countries which they had come to feel were their own. This is true of the dominant faction of the French Jewish community, which was not pro-Zionist around the time of the Balfour Declaration. This is true of both Jewish members of the cabinet, who insisted that the British cabinet, who insisted that the Balfour Declaration include a clause saying that nothing in this shall be taken as jeopardizing the position of integrated Jewish communities in European countries. And it was true of most American Jews. It was really not until the Biltmore Conference of 1942 and the beginnings of the revelation of the Holocaust that Zionism really won over a majority of the American Jewish community. And by this I mean secular Jews. Most religious were not concerned one way or another. They were not Zionists, they were not anti-Zionists, they paid no attention. When they didn't like it very much, but they paid no attention. But in the secular community, really there was a transformation in the 1940s. Not the 30s, the 40s actually. Partly because of the Holocaust, but for other reasons too. And that's it's interesting. I mean, this has been obliterated in the memory of people. Nobody really. The New York Times was not a Zionist paper in the 30s, for example. Most well-integrated, prosperous German Jews were not pro-Zionist. It was a different segment of the American Jewish community that tended to be the most ardent Zionists in the 20s and the 30s, Eastern European Jews mainly, secular, some of them socialists, some of them leftists, some of them right-wing. And it's part of an evolution. I talked a little bit about some other evolutions later on in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It's an earlier phase of evolution. That's changed in Britain and it's changed in France. I mean, the arrival of Jewish refugees from Arab countries in the wake of, you know, either riots and killings of people, or just a sense that they were unwelcome. In Morocco, nobody was killed, nobody was forced out, but most of the Jewish communities left. There's still a Jewish community in Morocco, but most of them left. In Algeria, the Jewish community, they all left. Not because Jews left, all French people left. And the Jewish community of Algeria was French from 1871. So they left because they thought of themselves as threatened by the Arabs, just like every other French person did. The arrival of this new community in France has really changed the French Jewish community. And it's become much more pro-Israel and much more Zionist than it was in the 60s or the 50s, for example. Though there was strong support for Israel even then. But you go back to the 20s and before, no. Nor in Britain, nor in. How do I account for it? I don't know how to account for it. That's just the way it was.
Well, I was asking how you account for it in your story or in your talk that you were saying that general Americans were influenced by the story.
Yeah.
And so I was just wondering how you...
Well, for general Americans, this didn't cause the same problems for their sense of what their status would be in the United States. One reason British Jews who were well established, like Lord Montagu, for example, like others, some members of the Rothschild family, was that they were afraid that heavy Jewish immigration to Britain, or saying that Jews had a homeland elsewhere and had a loyalty elsewhere, would cause their status in their societies to be cast into doubt. That's why a lot of the British Jewish leadership supported the Alien Exclusion Acts of 1904, which basically prevented Jewish refugees from the pogroms in Russia from coming to England, because they were afraid that the arrival of poor Jewish immigrants would lead to anti-Semitism, would jeopardize their position in Britain. So, I mean, how do I... People's views change. The Jewish communities in all of these countries are now pro-Israel, and at the same time are undergoing some of them the same transformations that are happening. I think in England, some of the same transformations that are happening in this country. How about letting someone else ask a question? Yes, sir.
Here in the U.S., we regularly receive news reports of terror plots in which a government agent was the principal actor.
Mm-hmm.
It creates the impression that we're living in a time where terror is a very ambiguous.
I'm not sure that I see an extension between what you're talking about and anything in the Middle East. The questioner said there are reports of terror plots in this country where government agents are involved. Is that what you're saying?
Are the principal players.
Motivators or players? I mean, there have been a couple of cases, I think, along the lines you're talking about, where an informer turns out to have been the person who's pushing the plot. Yeah, in this country. And the question was, are there cases in terms of terrorism in the Middle East? I don't actually think so, no. I mean, you're suggesting, are there agents provocateurs who play a role? Well, I mean, many people suspected that the Abu Nidal organization, which was a terrorist group that carried out a huge number of attacks in Europe and in the Middle East. They're the ones who attacked a synagogue in Istanbul. They attacked a transit center for people leaving the Soviet Union in Vienna. They carried out an attack on a synagogue in Paris. But they also attacked PLO representatives in about 12 countries. There's always been a suspicion. There was not a suspicion. It was pretty much confirmed from my understanding that the Abu Nidal organization was like a glove into which various intelligence services put their fingers. We know that several Arab governments really were responsible for Abu Nidal, the Libyans at some stages, the Syrians at other stages, the Iraqis at other stages. And they were acting as agents of those governments sometimes. I mean, Abu Yad was killed by a Abu Nidal agent who was probably acting for the Iraqis because he opposed the invasion of Kuwait, and he opposed the line that Arafat was taking. So those kinds of things we do know happened. And we know that the Israeli intelligence service had penetrated Abu Nidal up to some point, but were they manipulating him? I don't know. Were they trying to find out information? I don't know. We don't know. We know that everybody penetrated them, but we don't know. What's his name? Yossi Melman has a book about Abu Nidal, and he implies that the Israeli intelligence service had penetrated them. I just don't know. I don't know the answer to your question. If there's nobody else, I'm going to give this gentleman another crack. There's this guy. Sorry. You'll be next, okay? Take it easy. Yeah.
I'm looking for some voices of hope.
Voices of hope. Oh, boy.
Voices and new voices in Palestine, young people, any movement.
Good, good question. Are there any voices of hope, any movements, any young people who give me reason to say it may be different? Yes. The good news is yes, there are. First of all, what I said about Hamas is actually true of most of Palestinian society. There's been a turning away from a sense that violence is going to achieve anything. Against this enemy, which is this powerful, it is actually pretty clear that it's counterproductive. And fortunately, that's not that's become a more and more, people are more and more convinced of that. That doesn't mean there won't be any violence. In fact, there's no guarantee of anything. Public opinion doesn't control these things. A small group could carry out any kind of act. But I think it's a good thing. There's also a sense that it's not enough to just passively lie back and let Abu Mazen negotiate. That's not going to get anything. That's clearly not going to get anywhere. And that there has to be some kind of resistance to the continued seizure of land, the continued building of settlements on stolen Arab land, the continued building of fences that separate people from their agricultural property, and so on and so forth. And that process is gaining some kind of traction. Opposition to takeovers of houses in the Jerusalem area by Israeli and Arab groups together. Those are things that I think are a sign of a little bit of maturity, because the violence against Israel has, I think, shown that it just is not going to work. Certain kinds of violence are immoral and wrong, but any kind of violence, given the imbalance of forces, and given the situation in which Palestinians find themselves in, which is a situation where they're really under the complete control of the Israeli occupation. Everybody, for every important act, has to get permission of Israel. You want to go to Jordan to visit your family, you need permission. You have to visit the security services. You have to subject yourself to interrogation. You have to listen to offers. If you do this for us, we'll let you do that. You want to send your uncle to get medical treatment at Hadassah, you've got to go through the same process. You want to go through this checkpoint, you have to go through the same process. So in a situation where the Israelis have complete knowledge of every citizen, every subject, I should say, under their control, much greater, obviously, in the West Bank than in Gaza, because they're not inside the Gaza Strip in the same way. Clearly, the situation is just not in any way propitious for that kind of thing, and some other kinds of resistance. Though the Israelis, to their credit, given how competent they are at what they do, have arrested everybody involved in nonviolent protest, everybody involved in attempting to disrupt with the building of this fence through people's property and so on and so forth. There are dozens of nonviolent leaders in Israeli jails now. So they crack down on them as much as they crack down on anybody else. The other thing that's interesting is the growth of activism involving both Palestinians and Israelis over things like boycott, divestment, sanctions, means of changing the situation without violence, but which give people the sense that you can actually do something. Because one of the biggest dangers is apathy and depoliticization. And that's what the occupation is aiming for. It aims to turn these people into silent, cowed subjects who will just let Israel maintain the status quo and take what it wants and impose whatever kind of settlement it eventually deigns to impose on some weak client authority in Ramallah. And there's some of that, and there's also some feistiness and some willingness to try and do stuff. And there, it's a minority in Israeli society, but they find a response in some parts of Israeli society. So those are all good signs, I think. The problem is a lot of the Israelis who see how bad the situation is leave. There are hundreds of thousands of Israelis in this country. Now, some of them are, ordinary Israelis. They have no political views. A lot of them are the people who realized exactly how bad the situation is. And you find them all over American universities. You find them all over New York. Come to New York. On the Upper West Side, you hear Hebrew as much as you hear Spanish. The main languages are English and Spanish, but you hear almost as much Hebrew. Sir, I'm going to give you another shot. I know there are other people.
And you anticipated some of my questions. Which
I did. Okay. Admit
that Hamas and the Palestinian political entities as they exist are mostly dictatorships. They're pretty bad for the Palestinians as well as anybody. And so my question was, which you partially answered, is there viable, are there people who are willing to, let's say, move their concerns to the political realm as opposed to the realm of violence? And until they do, what can Israel do but defend itself?
Okay, I think I got the question. The question is, I've already said that both of the major political Palestinian political formations are bankrupt. I think that's the term I used. And is there any sign of people moving towards political means? And what can poor Israel do except defend itself? Well, there's a doctrine of proportionality in self-defense. It's a doctrine in international law. It's not my view or your view or, you know, a view that we determine by a poll. It's a doctrine of international law. And, you know, self-defense is self-defense. I already said any country has obviously the right to self-defense. But there's a question of proportionality. And that's the rule of international law that's violated by the kind of hammering of Gaza that took place during the assault of December 2008, January 2009, where 1,400 people are killed. The total number of Israelis killed at that time was 13. Most of them soldiers, most of them by friendly fire. So almost nobody's killed on the Israeli side, except that some soldiers killed in the operation, one or two civilians, and 1,400 people are killed. Devastation which still hasn't been repaired 2 years later. It's utterly disproportionate. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is the Palestinians have tried political means. And I'm not arguing against political means. I think you have to have political means, but you have to have some means of leverage at the same time. That's what's missing. And the political means have led to a situation where when the negotiation process that I was involved in started in 1991, I was involved in it for 2 years until the summer of 1993, there were 200,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem. There are today over 500,000. When I spent a lot of time living there, you could go anywhere freely in the late 80s and the early 90s. You could take a West Bank car and drive to the Gaza Strip or to Eilat. You could drive to Gaza. Today, Palestinians drive on a system of rickety roads, broken down roads, separated completely from the road system of the settlers in the occupied West Bank. There are two road systems. There's a situation where essentially enormous amounts of land have been taken over for the building of this wall fence, mostly inside the West Bank. The situation, in other words, has deteriorated. Most of this, sadly, took place not after the Second Intifada started in 2010. Most of this took place in the 90s. The expansion, the beginning of this massive expansion of the settler presence, the taking of land, the building of bypass roads, the building of the security fence, all of this stuff antedates the Second Intifada, when the suicide bombings took place. And that's the pretext for the wall, at least. It's not the pretext for the bypass roads. The bypass roads were intended essentially to enable the maintenance of an Israeli settler presence in the West Bank, even as Israel was negotiating with the Palestinians. And that was the problem with that negotiation. That's the problem with the current negotiation. And it's what the Palestinian delegation in Washington told the Palestinian leadership. The United States has given us assurances that actions by either side that prejudice or prejudge the outcomes of the final status negotiations, which kept being deferred and deferred, were to be, you know, prevented. If you're doing something that makes it forecloses the options for the final status negotiations, that thing should be prevented. And the argument was the closure of Jerusalem, which was the beginning of the whole system of closures that now encompasses the West Bank, and the continuation of settlement prejudges and prejudices things that are supposed to be negotiated in final status, and which we were not allowed to negotiate in Washington in the interim negotiations that led ultimately in Oslo to this interim self-governing authority, the PA. That was true then, it's true now. And so Palestinians are being told, negotiate while we eat the pie, the pizza pie that we're supposed to ultimately determine the division of. That is a process that is systematically designed to slap the weaker party in the face while guaranteeing that the weaker party cannot get what it wants because it's being taken during the process of negotiation, obviating the point. And so if you want to ask why did Hamas gain so much support in the late 90s and in the early 2000s? It's partly because Palestinians witnessed that the result of the negotiation process was an entrenchment of the occupation and an expansion of settlement. The peace process brought the closing off of the possibility, or very likely or very possibly the closing off of a possibility of a two-state solution. It did not bring a two-state solution closer. It made it much further away. In other words, the dynamics that were actually taking place while negotiations were ongoing from 91 until 2000 were processes that obviated the possibility of a successful negotiation. That's the problem with the political path. And that's why Hamas, unfortunately, succeeded in winning so many people to a doctrine of violence and armed struggle. So, in other words, Israel's actions pushed Palestinian public opinion to a position where they were easy prey for Hamas. One more question? One more question. I am willing to take a question, but I'm going to see if there's one more student. There's a student up at the back. You in the black coat, sir. Okay, I'll answer that question. I'll take one other. Question is, what is the role that Israeli settlements play in the West Bank, on life in the West Bank? One more question. There was an old... Yes, sir.
Well, I know that...
That's the last question.
I know that you say you're not... You're a historian, you don't predict the future, but I'm just wondering about your analysis of the current situation in which Israel's quite content the way things are.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, what could happen? What could make it better?
Okay, the questioner said, I know you don't like to predict the future, but given the situation you've described, what can make the situation better? Easier to answer this gentleman's question. What is the role of the settlements? The settlements show the Palestinians that there's a dynamic in Israeli society which, even though I myself think most Israelis would really like to settle this, is a very powerful dynamic in favor of settlement and in favor of maintenance of Israeli control over the West Bank. It also shows them that, in a certain sense, negotiating has not gotten them anything. In other words, it's gotten them a much stronger, much more powerful settler presence. What do settlements actually do? Well, settlers are Israeli citizens. They are governed under Israeli law. They vote in Israeli elections. They're subject to Israeli law. They're not subject to military law, which is what Palestinians are subject to in Area C, the largest part of the occupied West Bank, or to the actions of the Israeli army, which is what Palestinians are subject to anywhere in the occupied territories. They're only governed under Israeli civil law, and they have impunity from the Palestinians. Palestinians can attack them, obviously, which does happen. But otherwise, they can act with the protection of the Israeli state, and they do act with the protection of the Israeli state, even when they carry out actions which the Israeli state describes as illegal, such as setting up illegal settlements. You find that somehow roads have been built to those settlements, electricity has been extended to those settlements, other services arrive in those settlements. The Israeli government gives those citizens every other benefit and right that other Israelis get, and the military protects them. So essentially, they have both impunity and the protection of the Israeli state, pretty much whatever they do. And all you have to do is go to Hebron, and you can see this. I mean, the behavior of the settlers in Hebron is particularly repulsive. It's the most extreme in many respects. But, they're protected by the Israeli army and everything they do. Now, the paradoxical byproduct of this is that lots of work in these settlements is done by Palestinians. Most of the building is done by Palestinians. You have a population that's impoverished and that is desperate for work, and sadly, it is willing to work to help its own people's dispossession. And so if you look at pictures, there was a picture in, I think, the New York Times this morning of work going on in a settlement, I think in Ariel. In the northern part of the West Bank, if you look very closely, the guys in those construction helmets are Arabs, Palestinians, probably from villages nearby, some of which may have had their land stolen by these people. So there's enormous interruption of people's lives because the settlements are constantly expanding onto, almost all of them are on illegally stolen land, private land or otherwise Arab land. And they're constantly encroaching on their neighbors, whether for security reasons or because they just want the land or because they want to build more houses. And especially in periods of tension like now, the olive harvest, there's awful tension going on because the settlers try and interrupt the villagers from harvesting their olives, and if they're not harvested now, the olives are no good. So it's a terrible situation. It's exacerbated by the fact that this fence, most parts of the West Bank, it's a fence. Near Jerusalem, it's a wall. And in a few other areas, it's a wall. This fence, wall, whatever, this barrier, snakes through Palestinian land, and almost all of it is built on Palestinian land. And in many places, it separates the villages from their agricultural land with the purpose both of ultimately ensuring that that land is on the Israeli side of whatever border is ultimately drawn, and secondly, keeping the settlements within some kind of security barrier. And so this is an enormous problem, because the settlements were sited, located purposely in ways as to make a contiguous sovereign West Bank state or West Bank Gaza state an impossibility. Things like Ariel, things like Ma'ali Adomim. Ma'ali Adomim is a huge settlement to the east of Jerusalem, almost reaching to Jericho, almost reaching to the Jordan River Valley. Ariel is an east-west settlement south of Nablus, which would cut the Nablus area off from its extension, cuts the Nablus area off from the rest of the West Bank. So the settlements play a huge role. As far as the answer to your question, sir, I just don't know what's going to happen. I would argue that this is an unsustainable, unstable situation, the status quo. The fact that people in this country, our government, is blind to that, or is at least incapable of doing anything about that. The Arab governments seem to be incapable or unwilling to do anything, and the Israeli government is incapable of doing anything, and the Palestinian authorities are feeble unable of devising a strategy to change this, means that I don't think we're going to see much in the short term. The problem is, because it's unstable, it could break down in any unexpected way, and who knows what changes that would lead to. You also have dynamic actors like Iran, which are playing with fire, or capable of, you know, further destabilizing the situation. You have an American-Iranian Cold War. You have Israel's concerns about the potential of Iran developing a nuclear weapons program, which we don't know where it is or if it is, but there are concerns about it. And you have the fact that Lebanon, that in Hezbollah in Lebanon, Iran has a protege, and the United States and Israel are both very concerned about that. So that or something inside the occupied territories could lead to, at some stage, a further conflagration. That's the concern. And any conflict that eventually involves Iran, to my way of thinking, would be very, very grave. I think that the problems that we've seen with Afghanistan and with Iraq pale in comparison to what would happen if we ended up in a war with Iran. I think Iran obtaining nuclear weapons, if in fact they are moving in that direction, as some people fear, would be a really bad thing were it to happen. But I think a war with Iran would be catastrophic for the United States, for a number of Middle Eastern governments, for the price of oil, for countries like Saudi Arabia. It would really, really be very, very grave, I think. So that's something that seems to me would be urgent to avoid. And we are being pushed towards a war by the Netanyahu government. They seem to really want us to take on Iran. They say because there's a concern about Iran developing nuclear weapons. If they are in that mode, if they're going in that direction, it's many years off, but we're being pushed towards this. I think it's something that really should be resisted. I think it's not likely, but I think it's something that, to the extent to which it's serious, it should really be resisted. This is very, very dangerous. And even if we avoid that, and I hope and think that we can, there's enormous volatility in Lebanon around things to do with Hezbollah, the balance inside Lebanon, and there's enormous volatility in the occupied territories. I mean, you push people to despair the way the people in Gaza are, you can't predict what's going to happen. They've been pushed beyond the point of despair. Now, maybe they'll stay apathetic, and maybe they'll erupt. And if they do, you will. Of course, we're going to hear the same voices talking about, you know, oh, they're bombarding whatever, using whatever rockets. But what you have to think is what has been done to them over these many, many, many years. And this has to be ended. The siege of Gaza has to be ended just as a precondition for anything. I do not understand how Palestinian negotiators can sit down with the Israelis without saying, the first thing you have to do is lift the siege of Gaza. You want to have a boycott of weapons or prevent stuff from going in? Fine. You don't like Hamas. We don't like Hamas. Fine. But you cannot punish the entire population of the Gaza Strip because of your political objection to the government that seized power there in July 2007, even if the PA in Ramallah doesn't like that government. They should, if they had the slightest self-respect, that's what they should say. And that's what I would argue the United States government should say to Israel. Whatever you want to do to Hamas, that's fine, or not fine, but that's another issue. But the suffering being inflicted on the people of Gaza is completely impermissible. And I think it's disgraceful that our government doesn't take that position, frankly. Thank you very much. Thank you.